Hi, good morning, Calvary. Happy Name Tag Sunday. My name is Marianne Katz, and I'm part of the Women's Ministry and Calvary Kids. And I picked Pegasus for my zoo animal. I don't know about the rest of you. So anyway, we're reading John chapter 4, and I will be reading 1 to 15. Please follow along on the slides. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" For Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who is it that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water."
Well, I'm really appreciative for the time that I was allowed to be away from the pulpit over the last 2 weeks, but especially grateful for Larry and Brody for preaching during that time. But man, what a time to be away. I mean, we had an assassination. I mean, just in itself, a picture of the explosion of political violence that's been going on in our country, and then the celebration of that violence. And then to have a shooting just up the road again, let alone all that's going on in the world around us with drones entering into airspace and the difficulties in Asia with weather or political upheaval or war. And it's hard. It just continues to be hard. When you look at the scope of all that's going on around us, the pain that people go through, the way we treat each other when we're all suffering, and then to get messaging in the midst of it from people who aren't part of the church saying what the church must be about, despite the fact that there's no biblical warrant for it. It's so hard to navigate everything. Let alone it wasn't the most restful of times last Sunday. And Emily and I were away, but we didn't have grand plans. We were just going to be home, get some rest and recovery. But instead, we spent last Sunday morning at the ER at Children's. Everett ended up needing to get a stitch. And he's doing fine now. He's a little under the weather, but he's running around happy as usual. But I'm still not sure if Emily and I are fine following it. I can't imagine how you're navigating everything. Maybe it's the things that I've mentioned or things that I'm just not aware of. The amount of things I'm unaware of is alarmingly high. Maybe it's the economy that's made your job disappear or become difficult. Or the purchasing of things that we need or have grown accustomed to just isn't feasible anymore. I can't possibly know all that you're trying to navigate. I can only say I know it's been really, really hard. What do you do in a time like this? I had the opportunity to lead a devotional at our all-staff meeting this past Tuesday. So the three campuses that we have, all the staff from there got together, and I was asked to share something that I've seen God doing or that I've been learning, and I just didn't know what to say. I was just feeling overwhelmed and didn't have a direction. I mean, what do we say is the comfort? What's the relief? What is the source of encouragement that we have? And it's just in thinking about that something clicked into place, because nothing would come to mind other than our church. Our church is a place that does exactly that. And so I went to a passage that I like in 2 Timothy chapter 1, where Paul is talking about a really difficult time in his life. He's in prison. He feels abandoned by those who are close to him. He doesn't have the resources, feels alone in all of life. But he recalls the ministry of a man named Onesiphorus, who by his love and care and compassion, Paul says that this man was a refreshment to me. It's the wording that he uses. That when we go through difficult, that the people God puts in our life are as if we're getting a cold drink of water on a hot day. We're taking a bath after just feeling like we've been beaten up all week long, like getting a massage when we just feel tense and unrelaxed, that people can be that much of a refreshment for us. I shared in this time with the staff that this past Sunday when Everett fell, we text everyone that we knew who was in the medical field to see what it is that we should be doing. And one of the people that we text was Nancy Mitchell. She's a nurse in the schools around here. And she didn't get back to us right away. It was totally fine. It was absolutely fair. We don't tend to look at the clock on Sunday because we normally have a routine, but we realize, oh, it's 9:05 on a Sunday. Of course, she's in church and none of us are on phones in church. And she eventually did get back to us and she gave some encouragement, but then she asked the greatest question that Emily and I will ever get. Can I come? Nancy made it to where we weren't alone that day. We didn't have to process by ourselves. We didn't have to feel like we were going through it without anyone knowing. She even showed up with a little stuffed astronaut for Everett. And I got to tell her in first service, I got to look at her and say, Nancy, you were a refreshment for my family. And I will be forever grateful for that. We need the church. We need the people that Jesus puts in our lives to point us back to the work that he does for us. And how do we make it with all that goes on in this world where there's no possible way that we can except for with each other? Now, I do have bad news. None of this is part of my sermon. I see the clock is already ticking down with my time, but it's actually incorrect because my time has not yet started. All of that was a freebie. But there is a link to our passage. There's a connection with all that's around us, this feeling, this longing for something in the midst of all the difficulty of life. And that's not just something that's being felt in the church. We're not the only ones with eyes to see what's going on. Now, it's been remarkable that so many people, especially young people, have been craving more than the answers that they've been given, have been craving more than the solutions that we've established and set up as a culture, have been craving more than anything that we are possibly able to do or define or act out on our own. And especially in places like Europe that have been called post-Christian. The church was vibrant and flourishing there before, but now the church is said to be dead. But it turns out it was just about as dead as Jesus was, as people are flocking to him in droves, because the answers that we have don't seem to line up. The things that we have in this world to hold on to put our hope in, just seem to crumble. Then when we look on news story after news story after news story, the often repeated statement is, there has to be more than this. There has to be something that satisfies, that quells the craving that's in every single person. In our passage today, we have a person. So she has that same craving, that same longing for satisfaction. She's known simply, we don't know her name, but she's known simply as the woman at the well. And we see that she too is longing for that same thing that all of us do. Now, as we get into the story, there's a little bit of background work that we need to get to understand the full depth of what's going on. Simply put, to start with, Jesus is moving from Jerusalem, where the last couple stories have taken place, back up to Galilee in the north, where most of his ministry occurs. Now, to do so, verse 4 tells us that he had to pass through Samaria. Now, there's quite a bit of history between Samaria and Israel, and not much of it's good history. Over this past summer, we looked at the Old Testament storyline, and we came to a point where God's people, the nation of Israel, divided into two. You had the northern kingdom, and you had the southern kingdom. So the north became its own separate country, and the south, which included Jerusalem, became its own separate country. There it is. Now, there's a point after that that the northern kingdom was conquered, and the people were taken into exile. Not everybody, there was a remnant that was left behind. But whenever there is land available, people will flock to it. And so people from all these different nations came to where these Israelites used to live. So you had the Jewish people there, non-Jewish people, and they begin to intermarry. Well, that was a big no-no to the southern tribes. So they no longer saw them as fellow Jewish people. They saw them as something different, something foreign, something pagan. And so when it comes to worshiping God, which many of them hung on to worshiping the one true God, Israel to the south said, well, you can't come to the temple. You're not the right people, so you can't come. And so the solution was simple in the northern kingdom. Build your own temple. Well, that creates new rivalry as the debate becomes who is worshiping God the right way. Now, unfortunately, and we've seen this in our country, whenever you have two different groups convinced that their way is the only right way, it can often devolve into violence and years of warring between the Samaritans and the Jewish people to the south occurred. It got to the point, for everyone's sake, well, we will just decide not to associate with one another, but the animosity never disappeared. You would have some Jewish people who are called to be the people of God, who were specifically called to model God's love for the nations, for the world. Some of them would say something like, well, the only good Samaritan is a dead Samaritan. And that is the place that Jesus, a Jewish man, goes to. We're told that as he's traveling, it gets to the sixth hour, so it's about noon, the hottest part of the day. So he's thirsty, and he sits down at this well. His disciples go off to get food. And while he's there, up comes this Samaritan woman. Now, Jesus, as a good Jewish man, should have nothing to do with her on both of those descriptions of Jesus. One, he's Jewish, so he should not associate with a Samaritan. The idea was if you came into contact with a Samaritan, you would be religiously unclean, ceremonially unclean. So you couldn't go to the temple, you couldn't worship God until you cleansed yourself. But he's also a man. And here's this woman. And the idea being that if a man spoke to a woman who's not his wife in public alone, well, that would bring some criticism as well. So he should have nothing to do with her. But that's not all that we're told that helps us to understand the background here. We're told quite simply that this woman is coming by herself to get water at noon. That is unusual. For one, getting water became a group effort. A lot of women would go at the same time to get water. For one part of that is it was difficult to draw the water, so you need help from other people. But then it became kids wouldn't be, like especially young children, wouldn't be left at home. And so you'd have this whole parade of people that would go and get water together. It became kind of the social high point of the day for the women and for the kids in the village. But this woman comes alone. Not only that, it says that she's coming at noon. As I said, the hottest part of the day in the Middle East. That's not something you want to be doing. But it also is that when you drew water, that's what you needed for all of your work for the day. It's what you cook with, it's what you clean with. And so the women would go and get water at the very start of the day so that they could do everything that they need to do. So it's interesting that this woman comes alone at noon. What that tells us and what the rest of the passage affirms is there's something about this woman that makes her an outcast, unwelcome in her village. Unable to associate with the other women. And in a group culture like Samaria would have been, it is damning to be alone, to have nobody that you can count on. And here she walks up to Jesus and a conversation starts. Now, what's really interesting is when we think about this passage, maybe it does for you as well, but it makes me think of the last interaction that Jesus had. Back in chapter 3, we read about how a man named Nicodemus comes to Jesus and asks some questions and learns from him. Now, the very next time Jesus interacts with anybody, because the passage Brody preached on, we don't hear of Jesus in there. The very next time Jesus interacts with someone is this woman at the well, and they could not be more different than one another. With Nicodemus, we have this religious leader, this man who comes to Jesus at night to not be seen associating with Jesus. And now we have this, and one other piece on that. When we get to the end of the story, after Nicodemus hears from Jesus, it just kind of ends. Like, there's no response from Nicodemus. We don't hear anything about him until chapters later. It just stops. It's left ambiguous as to how did he respond to Jesus. But now we get to this woman who could not be more different than Nicodemus. She's Samaritan, not Jewish. She's a woman, not a man. She's an outcast, not an upheld religious leader. She comes during the day, not at night, but even though she does so, it's clear that her life is very much so lived in darkness. But we get to that last piece. How then will she respond? Will that be similar to Nicodemus and just kind of end? Or will that be different as well? Well, the beginning of her response shows that she's clever. She's quick-witted. She has this kind of playful side to her. I hope that comes through as you read the passage. It all begins with a very simple question. Jesus asking for a drink of water from her, and her response is essentially, "You sure about that? You want a drink of water from me? Isn't that going to make you unclean? You're not going to get all icky and whatnot by getting this from me?" And it starts this playful back and forth between her and Jesus. Jesus responds and essentially comes down to, "Oh, you don't know the half of it. If you knew who I was, if you knew who was asking this from you, you'd actually ask something from me because I can give you living water." See, Jesus is so good at this. He takes a very normal conversation and turns it into a spiritual conversation, able to get the heart of the matter, to get to what this woman truly needs, what she is truly longing for. Now, water is something that shows up quite a bit in the Gospel of John. We've already seen it back in chapter 3. And to understand what does he mean by water, and clearly he means something different. They're talking about physical water, but now he's talking about living water. He's speaking metaphorically. So what does it mean? What does this water mean that John keeps writing about in his Gospel? Well, to understand that, we need to go to John's sources, which is almost always going to be the Old Testament. And when we read through the Old Testament, water shows up a lot, and not always in the physical, literal understanding of water. When we look at the meaning of water, it has all kinds of different meanings. We saw in John chapter 3 that it's this cleansing. God promised that he would cleanse his people with water, that he would make them clean and new, not marked by their sin, but marked by new life in him. Water becomes a picture of God pouring out his spirit on his people, showing that he is present with them, that he is right there dwelling in them. And the picture of that is a pouring out water. Jeremiah chapter 2 tells us that God himself is like a spring of water, where other people turn away from him to find water in other sources. And then finally, for our time at least, water gets used as this picture of salvation, that we have wells of salvation that we could drink freely from. And water continues throughout the Old Testament. We can go on and on about what it means in the Old Testament, but I'm already concerned that we might be lost in the depth of this metaphor. So let me boil it down for us, you know, because water. Essentially what Jesus is saying here is what he is promising in giving living water is he is giving access to God the Father that he can give as God the Son through the presence of God the Spirit, which draws us close to him. To make it really simple, what Jesus is saying here is he's offering nothing more and nothing less than everything you crave, everything you're longing for. But much like when Jesus talks about these spiritual things, most people just think of the physical, literal needs that are right in front of them, and this woman's no exception. Jesus asks for water. She says, "You asked for that for me?" Jesus says, "I can give you living water," and she's still just thinking about physical water. And so, in doing so, she actually still wants to drive a wedge between how Jewish people and Samaritans normally ask. She says, how could you get me water? You have nothing to get it with. Are you better than Jacob, our ancestor who built this well? You think you can do better than him? He wanted water. He had to dig a well. So how can you do more than him?" Well, Jesus doesn't want to play that game. Instead, he speaks to what's true. He says, "Anyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again." That's true of all water. But what he offers never runs out, never expires, never stops satisfying. The water that he gives eternal life. Well, the woman seems to be tired of this exchange at this point. She says something in verse 15 that feels like it's slamming the door on the whole rest of the conversation. Verse 15 says, the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Essentially, what she's saying is, yeah, I'll take this water. That sounds great. Never runs out. I never have to leave home for it. Maybe I have a little tap that I can get water just turning it on. And it never stops satisfying. Man, that sure would be nice. But come on, dreamer. That's impossible. You can't give me that. It seems to slam the door on the conversation of, you can't give me what you're saying. We're done here. But what Jesus is doing is showing her her greater need. One of the commentators that I read slash one of my favorite professors in undergrad put it this way. He says, even in his human fatigue and thirst, Jesus was fully satisfied. It was a Samaritan woman, competent enough to gather water for Jesus, who was the one in true need. And to show her this, Jesus continues the conversation. Felt like it should have been done. Conversation's over, but Jesus continues the conversation by asking a question. Now, it sounds like he's changing the subject. He's going down a different route. But what he's doing when he makes this statement, he tells this woman to do something, he's actually continuing the exact same conversation, trying to show her how he can give her exactly what it is that she wants, exactly what it is that she craves, how he can give her exactly this water that satisfies. This is verse 16. And Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." And the woman answered him, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying, I have no husband, for you've had five husbands. And the one you're with now is not your husband." Yeah, what you've said is true. See, what Jesus does here is he asks her to go and get her husband and come back. And she very simply, the first time that we never get a playful response or kind of a jab back, it's a really short, really terse answer. "I have no husband." Jesus found her pain point. Now, some people take Jesus' response here that she's had five husbands, now with one who's not her husband, as proof that she's maybe a prostitute or something like that. But it doesn't really make the best sense of the language here. Instead, what we know of the time is that women were not able to initiate the divorce process. They could not seek out a divorce on their own. So there's something about this woman that has made it to where she's now been divorced five times, been rejected by five different men, and now she's living with a man who's not her husband. But the unfortunate reality is she would kind of need to be. The situation for women at the time was dire. They couldn't own land themselves. They could rarely generate enough income to support their lives, and so she would need to be associated with a man who could help provide for her livelihood. But even this man doesn't have the decency to honor her with marriage. Now, it's hard to believe that he's doing this out of the goodness of his heart. Most likely, he's receiving some sort of goods and/or services in return. But what Jesus is saying in this response to this woman who's been chewed up and spit out by the society around her, to this woman who has to be reminded of her place every single day as she walks by herself to get water, who's reminded every day that she's not traveling there with the rest of the women, every day that she's been excluded and cast out, every day that she's been going through rejection again and again and again, and she has a visible reminder of that every single day. What Jesus says to this woman is, "I know. I see you. I know what you're going through. I know what it takes from you every time you walk to this well. I know what you're truly looking for. I know what you crave." Well, just like for many of us, when things start to get too real, when we have to go deeper than just surface level, when we're called out on something that we crave, we deflect. I tend to revert to trying to be funny. Maybe other people here avoid. Well, this woman goes back to her cleverness. She says, "Well, I could tell that you're a prophet, that you know this. So let me ask you a question. You know, just one that's been nagging my brain for a little bit." But she doesn't want an answer. It's a gotcha question. Maybe you've been asked one of these before. "Oh, you want to talk to me about God? Well, how about first you tell me, why would God allow this to happen? Oh, you're a Christian? Well, tell me, Jesus boy, what would happen if God created a rock that was too big for him? Or whatever that stupid question is. I've never understood it. Now, certainly some people are asking to learn, but sometimes a question is not one that they want answered. It's a deflection. We start talking about what every single person needs, what every single person craves, and that's God himself, and that starts to get too real. And so let's ask this question. Let's get direction going somewhere else. Let's get you talking about something lesser. Let's get you on the back foot. But Jesus has never been on the back foot, and he does not play this game here. The question he's asked is essentially, where's the right place to worship? And there's no right answer that Jesus could give as it's given to him. If he would answer that the right place to worship is Jerusalem, well, she could just say, ah, you're one of those Jewish bigots. If he was to say Mount Gerizim, where she would be used to worshiping, oh, I thought you were supposed to be a good Jewish boy. What would people back home say about you? There's just no winning in the scenario. But instead, Jesus is able to give the right answer because of who he is. And what he says is, because I've come, because I am here now, because I have come to bring exactly what you need, everywhere is the right place to worship. We said that this story is a contrast with that of the story of Nicodemus in chapter 3. And if we were to look at all the reasons why they are different, we could probably make quite the list. But the place where that contrast is made the most clear is in the response. With Nicodemus, we don't know yet. We don't know how he responds. With this woman, it could not be more clear. Verse 28. So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? And they went out of the town and were coming to him. This woman runs, leaving her water jar behind. I mean, from what we know about her in the story, the only thing that she was looking for that day was to get literal physical water. I mean, for goodness sake, the only thing that we know to call her as is the woman at the well, but she runs away from that place. Why? After all the effort to get there, after all the shame that she endures, why would she run back and then run back to the people that she is not allowed, not able to be part of, that she's ostracized from, that she's not a part of the community? Why would she willingly go to these people who have made it clear that she's not welcome? It's because of what she found. It's because of what she discovered. That on this day, she sees that Jesus is the one who satisfies. And Jesus is able to do that because, much like this woman, he knows you. He can say what is going on in the life of this woman, not because he had some particular knowledge about her, but because he knows the hearts, knows the situation of every single person, that he can look at you and say, I know you. I know what you're going through. I know what you've experienced. I know the hardship that you're enduring right now. He knows you, but doesn't just leave us in that place where it's good to know that he knows what it's like, that what we're going through. He doesn't just leave us in that place, but he brings about true and lasting transformation. This woman had her life radically changed this day because she met the one that she was longing for. That Jesus is the one who gives us life, and not just the existence of life, but the very quality of it. That in him we find the purpose we so lack. In him we find understanding for all that's confusing. In him we find direction when we don't know which way to go. That's found in Jesus alone. That he is the one who truly satisfies. He is the one that we all thirst for. He is the one that we crave and has come so that he can meet that need. Now, there's so much that we could do in this passage, and I feel like we are doing such a disservice to it. There's so much richness and goodness to it that we just don't have the time to get into all of it. I mean, we could camp out for a while on the fact that Jesus' ministry is cross-cultural and think of, well, what does that mean for us? How do we look at people that we might otherwise reject, say they're too different, that we don't have to draw near to them and see, well, because of Jesus, we do draw near to them, that we are changed because of what he models for us. Or the example of what it means for us after we begin to see Jesus and what he's done for our life, that much like this woman, we run towards others to help them to see that very same thing. Or even the model of what it looks like to follow Jesus. One of my favorite verses in this whole passage that we just do not have the time for. Verse 42, they said to the woman, these people who had alienated this woman, who were not part of her life, who made it quite clear that she was not welcome to be around them, they said to her, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe. for we've heard for ourselves, and we know this indeed the Savior of the world. I mean, think about what it means for us to follow Jesus. We hear the truths about him, but it's not enough to just hear that, to have it go in one ear and out the other. It truly is following him ourselves that make us his disciples. There's so much richness in this passage. But if I could camp out on just one place, we've said now a couple times, this passage is a contrast with the one that we see in John chapter 3 with Nicodemus. But do not let it be a contrast between this woman at the well and us. This story is given so that we can see what she discovered this day. That he is the one that every single person craves. That's being discovered right now in places like France and England, and it's discoverable right here in the city of Thornton as well. In a world that's full of pain and suffering, and it feels like it just keeps getting added to and added to and added to, that it feels like as we're trying to find solutions, a way to navigate it, it just sends us running in opposite directions, yet it's here that we find living water. The quenching of the thirst that every single one of us has, the longing for satisfaction. And we see that in the life of this woman. She begins the story as an outcast and yet is joined at the end with others. This woman who has the question of where is the right place to worship? And even though she's neither in Jerusalem or in Mount Gerizim, she discovers this day she's never been closer to God. A woman who is longing for so much in life leaves satisfied. It's a story that we can all participate in. A story that's for us to find, not just refreshment in life. We desperately need that too. But to find all that we long for. Now, I didn't know how to wrap up. I was struggling with it, bumping my head into a wall. But where could I go other than the beautiful words that we find at the end of Jesus' ministry in Revelation 7? Revelation 7 is this picture of what it looks like when Jesus has fully completed all of his work, the certainty of what is ahead of us, and says this in verse 16. It says, they, God's people, shall hunger no more, neither thirst anymore, nothing more that we long for. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb, for Jesus, is in the midst of the throne. He's ruling in the place he rightfully is, and he will be their shepherd. He will guide them to springs of living water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes.